Okay, so we're doing Pentateuch. I'm excited because it's one of my favorite classes and it's been so long since we've done it. I was going to say, by way of reminder, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and we can fast forward from there. But where last we were, remember, God brought Israel out of Egypt. He brought them to Mount Sinai, spoke the Ten Commandments, offered to make a covenant with them. I've referred to this many times because we see it referenced in the prophets. God looking back and saying, look, I made a covenant with you, which covenant you broke. And we saw they broke the covenant in about a month. You know, Moses was up on the mount for 40 days and 40 nights. Before he can even come back, they're worshiping a golden calf. God sent Moses back. He was very angry. He broke the tables of stone that had the Ten Commandments, chewed out Aaron, but on the way also prayed and asked God to forgive Aaron, and he would. He grinds up that golden calf, spreads it on the water, and makes everybody drink it. And we started chapter 33. I've got my trusty post-it note to let me know. We're going to start with chapter 33, verse 12. But in the early part of the chapter, Moses is so upset. It's like, I can't be in the middle of you people, and God doesn't want to come here. So he sets up a tent on the outside of camp where he'll go when he needs to talk to God. And it says how the people, when they see Moses going, they'd go stand outside their tent, showing respect, and Moses would go, and then Moses would come back. Apparently, Joshua was stuck staying there most of the time. It's hard to believe that he was there 24/7 for however long, but Joshua has the job to be there. But we want to pick up in verse 12 and see some of the conversation, because one of the things we see here very strongly is that Moses has a relationship with God unlike pretty much any other human being ever. God more than once says, I talked to Moses face to face. Although we'll put a qualification on that. That's a phrase, I believe the literal Hebrew might be mouth to mouth, because God is going to plainly tell Moses, you can't see my face and live, at least not in its full glory. But we pick up in verse 12, Moses is going to ask God to do some things. And I've got a list of three things in particular. Moses said to the Lord, see, you say to me, bring up these people. You haven't let me know who you'll send with me. Yet you said, I know you, and you found grace in my sight. Now, therefore, I pray, if I found grace in your sight, show me your way that I may know you. So the first thing Moses is going to ask God, show me your way. Teach me what I need to know. And we could say God had already started doing that and would do so on an ongoing basis. God would show Moses his way, and Moses would share that with the rest of the nation. Very important. And it said, and consider that this is your people. Verse 14, he said, my presence will go with you. I'll give you rest. Now, so God seems to be telling Moses that. In verse 15, he said to him, Moses says, if your presence doesn't go with us, don't bring us up from here. So Moses is basically saying, God, I want you to go with us. That's important because earlier God had said, I'm not going with you guys. I'm going to get so mad, I'll just wipe you out. I'll send an angel. Moses seems to be asking God, please change your mind. Please go with us. Verse 16, how will it be known that your people and I have found grace in your sight except you go with us? So we'll be separate, your people and I, from all the people that are on the earth. And it seems that God relents from what he had said earlier. In verse 17, the Lord said to Moses, I will do this thing that you have spoken, for you found grace in my sight. And you can make a reference at the very end of the book. In chapter 40, verses 34 to 35, it references the pillar of fire and cloud being there, symbolizing God's presence. So it seems this is an indication that God, although he doesn't change from who and what he is, that doesn't mean he can't change his mind. And he uses the term relent. And we're often happy when God relents from a punishment he might do. Yeah. I don't know if you might be like me. When I was young, sometimes my mom would decide I was going to have a certain punishment, and I was very happy if she would relent and change her mind. Didn't always happen, but I've learned sometimes I do that with my son too. So Moses asked God, go with us personally. So that's the second request, and God would answer that. Okay, now And verse 18 is very brief. He said, please show me your glory. Moses is asking God, show me what you're really like. You could say, let me see you the way you really are. I'm reading that into it, but he's asking, show me your glory. Well, God says, there's a problem with that. He says, I'll make all my goodness pass before you. I'll proclaim the word of the Lord before you. I'll be gracious to whom I'll be gracious. I don't mean to put that in that tone of voice as though it's blah, blah, blah. This is God talking about God. I'll have compassion on whom I will have compassion. But, he said, you cannot see my face, for no man shall see me and live. Now, we would read into this that must mean no man can see me in my full glory, the way I truly am, and live. Because we know he showed up and ate with Abraham, and he appeared to some of the others. So they must, you know, it seems when God came to Abraham back in Genesis 18, and they had that meal, and he told him, hey, I'm going to wipe out Sodom and Gomorrah. Well, are you going to wipe them all out? What if there's 50 righteous men? Are you going to kill them all? You know, how about sparing them for the sake of 50? You know the story. So Moses seemed to have seen, or Abraham at that time saw a face, but he didn't see it in his glory. Now that might raise the question, how does God do that? How come you can see him one way and it's not in his glory and another time and it is? And my answer is, I don't know. I have no way of knowing that. You know, I don't, you know, one of the things I say is maybe it's like he has a dimmer switch. He can turn himself down. And that seems kind of silly, but there's something he does that's different, and who am I to question it? It's in his word, but it's seemingly what he tells Moses is, you can't see my face in my glory and live. But he's going to give him a compromise. And he seems to be describing what will happen in the future. And I think that might be what's described in the next chapter, actually in chapter 34, verses 6 through 8, when God seems to make his glory pass before Moses. But he says, here in chapter 33, verse 21, here's a place by me, you'll stand on the rock, and it'll be when my glory passes by, I'll put you in the cleft of the rock, and I'll cover you with my hand while I pass by. Then I'll take away my hand, and you'll see my back, but my face shall not be seen. Okay, so what does that mean? I've often visualized this in two ways, and it often depends if I've wondered if God can turn up or down his glory, can he change his size? And to me, this is a speculation of something that doesn't matter, but I wonder when he says, I'll cover you with my hand, if like Moses is like this, and God comes up and says, okay, now you can see me walking away from behind. Good thing I kept. Or does it just mean, okay, he's coming up, so Charlie, I'm going to use you. So he's coming up, so he just does this, and then lets him see from behind. You know, he doesn't have to be Moses this big. It can be normal size to side, but in whatever way, I'm going to make sure you don't see what's going to kill you. And then, of course, then the question comes, why is the glory more prominent from the front than from behind? I don't know. It, you know, if we're made in God's image and likeness, generally we like to look each other face to face. Why the difference? You know, we'll have to ask him more when the time comes. Yes, Julia?
I was just thinking that maybe one of the, like, this is possible, this is my speculation, but maybe the reason why God didn't let Moses see his face is because even though it's Moses, there is a potential that if he knew what God actually looked like to face, it could be translated into graven images. Because, I mean, it's
that's
more likely
interesting
that
speculation.
You could make a graven image of, like, a face if you actually knew what the face looked like, but you're not going to worship someone's backside.
Well, that's debatable, but that's another question. Which I don't disagree. That's an interesting speculation, but God does say you can't see my face and live. So there's that has to be some element of it in some way or another. But not to discount what you're suggesting, because I think that's true. Yeah, Andrew?
Could you relate it to when Moses comes down from the mountain and his face is shining with glory and then the people couldn't even look at him, so they had to put a veil
over? It could be related, and we're coming up on that very soon. So, yeah, so Moses is exposed to God's glory enough later, his skin is going to be shining. And it says specifically his face. Maybe Moses has mostly covered the rest of his skin. You know, I'm not sure if he was wearing long sleeves and long pants or what exactly, how you would define that. So anyways, you know, God proposed it or says he's going to do this. So, and this is while they're talking down at that tent outside of camp, because now we're going to see God is going to tell Moses, come back up on the mountain. So we're going to meet more face to face. It almost sounds like, you know, they're talking by intercom or something at this time, which is kind of silly to say, because it seemed like the pillar came over to that tent when Moses went there. But, you know, you got to come up, you know, spend some more time on the mountain. It'll be another 40 days and 40 nights. But this is a lot shorter passage of Scripture. But here in verse 1, the Lord said to Moses, cut two tablets of stone like the first ones. I'll write on those tablets the words that were on the first tablets that you broke. And I say, why does Moses have to cut these out? Well, because God made the original ones. Well, it's sort of, you ever go into a store where the sign says, you break it, you bought it. You know, Moses broke the two tablets, so he's got to make the new ones. But God will write on them. Be ready in the morning, come up to Mount Sinai, present yourself. No man shall come up with you. Let no man be seen throughout the mountain, neither flocks or herds from before the mountain. This is like what God commanded before he came and spoke the Ten Commandments. Then he said, put cordons around and make sure no one else comes up. So they repeat that to some degree. It doesn't say that God's going to speak to all the nation again. That seemed to have been a one-time event. But in verse 5, it says, well, actually, verse 4, Moses did what he said. He cut out the two tablets. He headed up early in the morning. The Lord descended on the cloud and stood with him and proclaimed the name of the Lord. This might be God doing what he said about covering him with his hand and letting him see the back of him, although it doesn't say that. But it says, the Lord passed before him and proclaimed, the Lord God, merciful, gracious, long-suffering, abounding in goodness and truth, keeping mercy for thousands and forgiving iniquity and transgressions and sin, by no means clearing the guilty, visiting the, you know, the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and the children's children to the third and fourth generation. Moses made haste and bowed his heads. Or bowed his head. He only has one, I'm pretty sure. Sorry. I was thinking something in the back of my mind. It's interesting when God announces who and what he is, these are the things he says about himself. And he emphasizes good stuff. You know, that he's merciful and gracious and long-suffering, abounding in goodness and truth with mercy for thousands. But that point that we were discussing the other day in Major Prophets comes up. This visiting the iniquity of the fathers on the children of the third and fourth generation is still puzzling and somewhat troubling to compare to Ezekiel 18 and say, how does that work out? One of the things that crosses my mind, we talked about possible explanations, so I don't want to revisit all of it, but it's interesting that this seems to be presented as part of a title describing who God is and how he works, rather than in Ezekiel 18 where there's prose describing, you know, the results of things and how people can repent. I'm not saying that answers it, but it's one more factor perhaps in the discussion. Anyways, as I said, apparently Moses bows. Maybe this is when he gets to see God from behind. And he says, this is Moses speaking. If I found grace in your sight, O Lord, let me, I pray, go among us, even though we're stiff-necked. This is revisiting that request that we saw in the previous chapter that he's asking, please go with us yourself. Don't send an angel. We want you to go with us. So it seems to be, you know, repeating that. Even though we're stiff-necked, I mean, how many times you ask God for something and you acknowledge, I know I don't deserve this, you know, I don't earn this, but please do it anyways. Anyways. Okay, yeah, sorry. It's good if I read what I'm covering. Seems here that God formally renews the covenant or restores it. Remember, he made a covenant earlier and it was sealed and the Israelites broke it. So now in verse 10 he says, behold, I make a covenant before your people. And a lot of the same terms will be listed, but not as thoroughly. But I'll do marvels such as has not been done in all the earth among the nations, and you'll see the work of the Lord. It's an awesome thing that I'll do with you. Okay, this is what God's going to do. What do they have to do? The people, in verse 11, observe what I command you this day. Behold, I'm driving out before you the ites. Verse 12, take heed for yourself, lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land where you're going, and it be a snare. So God's saying, you're making a covenant with me. Don't make covenants with any other nations. And we see criticism later in the prophets because Israel would try to make covenants with other nations. God likens that to committing adultery, similarly to the way he compared worshiping idols to committing adultery. Okay, he didn't want them to make covenants. And he gives some of the reasons why specifically for the Canaanites. But first in verse 13, you'll destroy their altars, break down their sacred pillars, cut down their wooden images. Basically destroy any remnant, any things they have. I find it interesting that, I think he revisits this somewhere. I've got it somewhere else in my notes, but I've seen criticism of especially some of the radical Muslim groups in the Middle East for destroying ancient artworks because they're destroying them because they consider them idolatrous. And it was, oh, how can they destroy these thousands of year old images? And yet, you know, I hesitate because it seems that God commanded the Israelites to do exactly that. Destroy all their idols, every remnant of their civilization. He didn't say put it in a museum and explain it. So I'm not saying that I'm on the side of ISIS on this anyway, by the way, but it's worth keeping that in the back of our minds when we consider those commands. Okay, but he's going to continue. If I can read and continue. Verse 14, you shall worship no other god. So if you destroy all the idols and their altars and all that, it lessens the chance that you'll try to worship their other god. Lest you make a covenant with the inhabitants of the land and they play the harlot. Now, to their gods and make sacrifice to their gods. And one of them invites you and you eat his sacrifice. And you take of his daughters for your sons and his daughters and play the harlot and make your sons play harlot with their gods. Make no molded gods for yourself. I want to pause here because God clearly says, I don't want you guys intermarrying with those peoples. Now, among the Canaanites, he'd also said, kill them all off when you get there. So you're not going to marry anybody if they've all been killed anyways. But we have, in the past, in the church, we've taken this scripture and some others to say and interpret it as, okay, all interracial marriage is sinful and God forbids it. But, you know, in doing so, we didn't necessarily emphasize the reason God said, I don't want you to intermarry with them. And he clearly says the reason is you'll start worshiping their gods, and I don't want you doing that. You know, in more recent years, actually it's been recent decades, probably longer than most of you have been alive, the church stepped back from our earlier teaching and said, well, we think if we're being completely honest with the scriptures, God is not here condemning any and all interracial marriage. He's condemning any and all interreligious marriage. And that's something sometimes I bring up when we do talk about dating, and I know you guys have heard more than enough about that. But I've sometimes said, the Bible doesn't say you can't date outside the church, but it does say you can't marry outside the church. And one tends to go with the other. One of the things I add to that, I'm just going to make references here. Later, I'll be covering the post-exilic writings. But in Ezra 9, verses 1 and 2, and also Nehemiah 13, verses 23 to 27, the Jews that came back and were reestablishing the nation and building the temple were told, don't intermarry with the peoples there. Yes?
What was the verse in Nehemiah?
Nehemiah was chapter 13, verses 23 to 27. And the reason is given there, because you might start worshiping their false gods. One of the things that's interesting to point out is in those passages in Ezra and Nehemiah, the women that are most prominently mentioned of the other nations are those from Moab and Ammon. And I find it interesting, Moab and Ammon. If this is about not having interracial marriage, what's the problem there? Andrew, I thought you were going to raise your hand, but you were just scratching. What do we know about the ethnicity of Moab and Ammon, the peoples, and the men? Julia?
They're from Lot,
yeah. So basically they're the same ethnic group as Israel. You know, whether you want to call them white or some brand of Caucasian, we think they were something like that. So they're not a different race, but God still forbids intermarrying because it's the religious difference. So that's the thing I point out. Now, I add a note. None of this teaching or this adjustment from what we had for years and years is meant to imply that God suggests or wants interracial marriage. I don't want to go to the other extreme and say, oh, God really wants us to do that. There's no indication in the Bible of that. And we could, some people said, well, he made the different races because he wanted them different, you know, apparently because he likes the variety and such. And he doesn't address it other than in this context. So I'm pausing here because this is one of the first places it comes up. There's a parallel passage in the Pentateuch, it's worth noting, in Deuteronomy 7. Deuteronomy chapter 7, verses 2 through 8. He again talks about destroying the peoples, don't make a covenant with them, don't make marriages. And it says for, which where you see the word for in that type of grammar could be translated because, they'll turn your son away from following me. In other words, don't marry those Perizzites, Hittites, Canaanites, Girgashites, whateverites, because you'll end up worshiping false gods, not because you're going to have kids that look like a mix between the two races. Okay, more than enough of that, but I wanted to comment on it as we go by. Or maybe it's not more than enough, but it's much as I wanted to talk about here. And moving on in chapter 33, verse 18, the Feast of Unleavened Bread you'll keep. So I'm reminding us here God is restating some of the main principles of the covenant. So he reiterates the importance of weekly and annual Sabbaths. Keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. In Abib, the month of Abib when you came out of Egypt. And he'll touch on the Sabbath again later. Verse 19, all that opened the womb are mine. God had claimed the firstborn earlier, and he has the right to demand that. Basically, he says, look, I spared you the firstborn in Egypt. The firstborn belonged to me. And he basically said, pay a certain amount, you know, and the firstborn of the flocks you sacrifice or redeem. He'll describe that. Matter of fact, he describes that here, lies in verse 20. The firstborn of a donkey you shall redeem with a lamb. And if you don't want to redeem it, break its neck. Boy, I'd hate to be born a donkey. Verse 21, 6 days you shall work, but on the seventh day you shall rest. And then he adds something important. Not just when it's convenient. There's not an exception when there's a lot of work that's very important to get done. He says, in plowing time and in harvest you shall rest. What's the significance of plowing time and harvest? I don't know if anybody here has much of an agricultural background. I certainly don't. I'm a suburban kid. But some of you have probably studied enough. Is the Sabbath more important in plowing time and harvest or less important? Maybe I should ask, what does plowing time and harvest mean? Nate? Somebody pass him the mic. I'm pausing here because I think it's a point of emphasis God went out of his way to make.
Certain periods of time of the year where it's good for crops to grow, but then when the Sabbath comes up every week, stop what you're doing and keep the Sabbath.
Now you're on track there. Oh, Andrew?
Well, harvest or, let's see. Yeah. Sorry.
Plowing time and harvest.
Plowing time and harvest time. Well, plowing, you have to, you know, till up your ground, plant seeds, and harvest. You got to pick it all up and, you know, and reap it. So it's equally important, you know, to plant as it is to get what you plant.
Okay. And Kayla?
So when you are bringing in something, there only may be so many days of weather that are appropriate or correct for it, so it can make it seem like, oh, I need to hurry and get this finished. But
okay, that's an important factor, yeah. There are certain times of the year for farmers that time is of the essence. You got to get the plowing done and get the crop in. If you can't get it done by a certain time, you might as well not at all. And the same goes for harvest. And especially consider it might be rainy on a day you could work, so, you know, or the weather's not appropriate, and you think, oh, it was raining Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, now the weather is okay, I can harvest. And if I don't get the harvest done within a week, I'm going to lose it. Oh, sorry, God, I just have to work or my children will starve. God says, no, no, no. In harvest time, you know, in plowing time, you still keep the Sabbath. It's good. It's a measure of faith at some times. You know, I've been surprised. As I said, growing up in the city, we don't understand that. But I remember I've had some times where I was driving through, you know, rural areas. And in the fall, I've seen men with harvesters out there at like 10 and 11 o'clock at night with headlights on. And they're working into the night, which of course they couldn't do in Moses' time because they didn't have headlights and they didn't have combines. But, you know, there are certain times where you'll work around the clock if you have to meet that deadline. And it's not an imposed deadline by a contract. It's because of the forces of nature. God is saying, trust me, keep it even at those times. And there's going to be another qualification or, I don't want to say qualification, but special comment on the Sabbath in the next chapter that we'll get to. But I just want to emphasize there, the Sabbath is important. Verse 22, he goes on to mention the Feast of Weeks, which we call Pentecost, you know, first fruits of the wheat harvest. And then the Feast of Ingathering at the year's end. So he's mentioning the three festival periods. And we know Leviticus 23 is the place that gives the very specific detail on the days. Okay. So three times, verse 23, three times in the year all your men shall appear before the Lord God of Israel. And there will also be some detail on that. That's not saying women don't have to keep the feast, but as part, in the ritual system, the men are required to appear and make an offering. In verse 24, I'll cast out the nations before you, enlarge your borders, neither will any man covet your land. So God's going to give all these benefits. Verses 25 and 26, there's some regulations about sacrifice. Don't offer the blood of my sacrifice with leaven, nor sacrifice the feast of Passover, the sacrifice of Passover should not be left over till morning. Verse 26, the first of the first fruits of your land bring to the house of the Lord your God. So, you know, there's elements of the first fruits belonging to God and perhaps a reference to tithing. So he's hitting on the highlights of stuff he mentioned earlier. And here's a repeat of that command, do not boil a young goat in its mother's milk. And a lot of people are saying, why in the world would I do that anyways? But this is the second time he's mentioned it. And if you want a reference, if you don't already have it printed in your margin, the first time was in Exodus 23, verse 19. And I think in the majority of scholarly sources I've consulted say that they believe God gave this restriction because it was a Canaanite practice in that area at that time to do exactly that as a fertility ritual, to kill a young goat, boil it in its mother's milk, take the broth and sprinkle it on the fields and orchards and things to make them more fertile the following year. And God, he over and over again says, don't do what those Canaanites did. Don't do that to worship me. What we think it specifically does not mean, which the Orthodox Jews say that it does, we don't think that it means you can't eat meat and dairy together. And I mentioned this when we covered Exodus 23. So there's a reason God gave this, but it wasn't saying because cheeseburgers are a sin. If you're an Orthodox Jew, cheeseburgers are, you know, you think of them as a sin. Which seems kind of odd, huh? If you make it a bacon cheeseburger, you get to sin again by having the bacon. But that we do agree that you shouldn't eat the bacon. And I often give the reference, besides the fact that we know another explanation, if we think of that meal that God had with Abraham back in Genesis 18, what he had included milk and butter and beef. If God himself ate beef and milk together, I'm willing to do so. So next time you go to Wendy's, you can order the cheese. And I think you guys are with us on that. Okay, so anyways, verse 27, Then the Lord said to Moses, write these words according to the tenor of these words that I've made a covenant with you. So here's the reminder, here's a reiteration of the covenant. The people broke it, but it's being reinstituted. He was there with the Lord 40 days and 40 nights. He neither ate bread nor drank water. So I think God miraculously sustained Moses, or else, boy, was he strong. He wrote on the tablets the word of the covenant. We believe God wrote on the tablets, because there's other places that said he wrote them with his finger. But Moses wrote on a scroll all the words. Moses probably wrote everything else. And I would say he probably also wrote the Ten Commandments on the scroll. So the Ten Commandments were written by God on stone, written by Moses on the scroll. It's a good idea, because how many people get to look at the stones? Pretty much nobody. They're going to be put in the Ark of the Covenant. It's in the Holy of Holies, and nobody's allowed to go in there, except the high priest once a year. But everything's written out on the scroll, so it's available. Then something interesting. We could pass over this, but I think it's just kind of neat. Verse 29, when Moses came down from Mount Sinai, two tablets of the testimony were in Moses' hand. Notice he doesn't find a golden calf waiting for him this time. The people learned their lesson. Moses didn't know that the skin of his face shone while he talked with him. And Aaron, all the children of Israel, saw Moses. Behold, the skin of his face shone, and they were afraid to come near him. So they see he's glowing. And so, what's that? They run and hide, and Moses talked with them. So, no, it's me. Come here. So Aaron and the rulers of the congregation returned. Moses talked with them. Afterward, the children of Israel came near, and he gave them the commandments that the Lord had spoken. When Moses finished speaking, he put a veil over his face. Whenever Moses went before the Lord to speak, he would take the veil off until he came out. When he came out to speak to the children of Israel, they'd see his face was shining, so he'd put the veil back on. I sometimes wonder, because this leaves it hanging, does that mean this is the way Moses lived for the next 40 years? Is his face always glowing and he's got a veil, except for when he's talking to God? Or some have interpreted that after he's been hanging out with God for a while, his face starts shining again, and that's when he has to wear the veil. I don't think it matters to us. I'm sure it mattered to them at the time. But it's one of those things you just kind of wonder. But Paul, the Apostle Paul, used this to draw an analogy in 2 Corinthians 3, verses 13 to 16, where he makes the point that by having this veil to sort of shield people from God's glory is likened to the fact that most people have a veil keeping them from understanding the truth. So that's in 2 Corinthians 3, verses 13 to 16. I'm not going to turn there, but the idea is, okay, most people have some type of interference, and they're not understanding God's way. A similar thing could be looked at with the veil in the tabernacle, later the veil in the temple, although Paul doesn't draw that specific analogy. Do you guys follow me? And that's not something complex. One of the things I find interesting is the Hebrew word there for shown, or the translated sharon, is karan. We can transliterate it K-A-R-A-N, because it can be translated to shine, and I'm not sure if this is the verb form or adjective, but also to protrude. And you can imagine something shining out, something growing out, is kind of a protrusion is similar to shining. And the reason I point it out is I learned this from medieval art, of all things. And I am not an art historian or anything like that, but and I'm always sharing this because I think it's funny, but if you look, you can find medieval paintings of Moses, and it shows him with horns. You say, what are they showing Moses with horns? Are they saying he's demonic? They use this word Quran, and they translate it protrude, meaning they thought Moses came down and he had horns growing out of his face, rather than his face shone with light. And so there are artists who portrayed it that way. And I've seen some of the paintings. So I think later on, the more modern English translators got it correct. I'm pretty sure Moses didn't grow horns. But it's kind of funny that some people thought he did. Or maybe I'm the only one that thinks it's very funny, and some of you think it's funny that I think it's funny. But either way, it's still good. Okay, boy, I thought we were going to... Well, we're not doing too bad. What, we've done a chapter and a half? So we're going to move ahead a little bit more about the Sabbath because, okay, Moses has met with God for the second time on the mountain. He's going to talk to God on a regular basis on and off for the next 40 years. So it's not like he's done talking to God, but now it's time to kick into action. Moses gathered all the congregation, the children of Israel, and said, these are the words which the Lord's commanded to do. Work shall be done. So it's interesting. Get everyone together. We got to build a tabernacle. But the first, I got to tell you, keep the Sabbath. You know, so he's going to tell them how to build it, but he says, work shall be done for 6 days, but the seventh shall be holy to you, a Sabbath of rest. Whoever does any work on it shall be put to death. Kindle no fire throughout your dwellings on the Sabbath day. Then he goes on to talk about taking up an offering and building the tabernacle. So the reason I want to pause here is because there's something in this command about the Sabbath that we find here and here only as far as scriptural references. And it must be obvious to you what it is then. What is it? Kindle no fire. It's noting because once again, to give reference to the Orthodox Jews, they take that as a permanent command for every Sabbath day. Kindle no fire. And those who go to an extreme won't do anything that even could possibly make a spark, such as turning on a light switch. Or, of course, starting your car involves a lot of fire. You just don't see it because it's deep inside your internal combustion engine. Is that what this means? Because, face it, my furnace comes on and off. Of course, I'm not kindling it. It's got a nifty pilot light. I don't know if that gives an excuse. I don't know, Dr. Britt, do they allow pilot lights to just keep on going, or do you know? So modern thermostats are a great thing. Okay. But still, I've been camping. I've lit fires on the Sabbath before and not felt guilty. But still, if someone asks, how do you explain it? And I know we discussed this in passing when we talked about keeping the Sabbath, so I don't want to spend a long time on it, but I want to reiterate because here's where it is. And this is the only place in the Bible that says don't build a fire on the Sabbath. Charlie's got an idea.
Yeah. It's not so much lighting the fire. It's more the things that lead up to lighting the fire, the work that's involved. Because back then, you probably had to chop a lot of wood.
Could be, but I personally think the meaning is actually on the other side of lighting the fire rather than the work building up to it. Andrew? And I'll explain if someone...
Well, we talked about in Practical Christianity about how in that time there were people like blacksmiths who would, their job was, had to do with a fire. You had to light the fire to do it. And there are a lot of other things that, lighting a fire had to do with actual physical hard labor.
Yeah, so what you're doing with the fire. Danny?
I think we also discussed that where it's specifically placed, that it was in reference to the work that they would do to build the temple.
Okay, and I think that's it. One of the things I want to add, because I'm not sure who I heard this from, but I've heard a slight, I think a proper explanation that emphasized something that wasn't quite correct, because in the past I've heard people say that the word here for fire was a different Hebrew word that means industrial fire. And we've looked at it that way, but the truth is, it's the same word for fire as you see throughout the Old Testament. It's not a different word for fire. But the context does seem to be implying building fires for the metalwork that's going to be building the tabernacle, because it is in the context of we're building this. So that's one of the reasons I wanted to pause. The word for kindle is the same word as other places. The word for fire, if I transliterated it correctly, is esh. E-S-H. Let me try that again. Dr. Britt, does that match with...
Yeah, it can be either an
E
or an A.
Oh, okay.
The actual sound
like that? Which would make more sense because I relate ash to fire. So, and there could be a connection for all I know. Thanks for pointing that out. The way I'd seen it was with an A-E, but, the Hebrew letters, matter of fact, they don't have a Hebrew letter for A, do they? Or didn't when Moses was writing, at least. So anyways, I want to make the point that it's the context that tells us what kind of fire it is. And the context here is he immediately goes on to discuss this building the tabernacle. In verse 4, Moses spoke to the congregation of the children of Israel, saying, "This is the thing the Lord commanded. Take from among you an offering to the Lord. Whoever is of a willing heart, let him bring an offering to the Lord, gold, silver, and bronze." Now, he's also going to go on with blue, purple, scarlet thread. But I think the relation to the fire, gold, silver, and bronze. You're going to build a fire. And Bezalel and Aholiab are going to be building these big fires for metalwork, and probably others are, but not on the Sabbath. Just like the plowing and harvest are not an excuse to break the Sabbath, even building the tabernacle is not an excuse to break the Sabbath. Still keep the Sabbath. Okay, and it's interesting, this isn't a tax. Verse 5, whoever is of a willing heart, bring these items. it matches with the instruction in 2 Corinthians 9, you know, let every man give as he's purposed in his heart. God loves a cheerful giver. We recite that often on holy days when we take up an offering. That was 2 Corinthians 9, verse 7, if you want the reference. And I'll make the point, people obviously were of a willing heart. In the next chapter, we're going to see that they gave not only enough, but more than enough. And they had to tell them, stop bringing stuff. I'll comment on that in a bit, but it's in chapter 36, verse 5. But it's not just giving stuff. You know, you see the oil for light, spices for the anointing oil, that's verse 8, onyx stones, stones to be set for the ephod. But also all who are gifted artisans among them come and make all that the Lord commanded. So it's not just giving stuff. It's not just writing out a check. Those who had certain talents would come and do things. They would spin thread and weave cloth and give that. And it goes on to list all this stuff, which I'm not going to read, but verse 20 through 29 describes all these materials that either were just in bulk form or had to be produced. Verse 25, all the women who were gifted artisans spun yarn with their hands and brought what they had spun, blue, purple, scarlet, fine linen. All the women whose hearts were stirred with wisdom to spun yarn of goat's hair. I'm not sure how good a yarn goat's hair makes. Maybe that's why you have to have special talent and wisdom to do it. I've heard some people suggest that maybe where it says goats, it's really referring to the leather, because hair is in italics in most translations, because it's a word supplied by the English translators. But the spinning refers to making, you know, spinning and yarn refer to cloth. So I still think it's a curtain made with goat's hair, which must have been a pretty unique stuff. Where was I with this? Okay, verse 30. Moses said to the children of Israel, see, the Eternal has called by name Bezalel, the son of Uri, the son of Hur of Judah, and he has filled him with the Spirit of God and wisdom and understanding and knowledge and all manner of workmanship. We covered this earlier when God told Moses about Bezalel. Now Moses is sharing this with everyone else. And he has all these neat talents. In verse 33, cutting jewels for the carving of wood, all manner of workmanship. Verse 34, he also mentions Aholiab, the son of Ahizamech. God gave him special talents. He's filled him with skill to do all manner of work of the engraver, the designer, and tapestry maker. I like that. There's the threes. Was it the engraver, designer, and tapestry maker? What's that sound like? I'm thinking of the butcher, baker, and candlestick maker, which has nothing to do with this, but God had a way with words just as well as any speechwriter. He's filled them to do all, and all those artistic works. So, as I say, now after God had spent two 40-day periods telling Moses a bunch of stuff, Moses is sharing it, and now it's going to happen. In verse chapter 36, Bezalel and Aholiab and every gifted artisan in whom the Lord had put wisdom and understanding. Interesting, it shows that God chose who he put this wisdom and understanding in. Some people might have felt left out, and I can relate to that. You know, I've been left out of a lot of stuff that I didn't have particular talents. I was talking to Mr. McGee earlier about how back when I was in what we called YOU, I spent a lot of time on a bench watching people play basketball. Because I like to play, but I'm terrible at it. So, you know, some people, I'm not that talented. You know, so maybe they prayed and they supported, they fed them. Everybody can support the work in some way or another, but the most talented were the ones that got involved doing. Yes, Craig?
So can I back up for reverse for a minute? So in chapter 35, in verse 30.
In verse 30.
Where it mentions son of Hur.
Oh, yes.
Is this the same Hur from chapter 24, or is this someone else?
I believe it's the same.
It's the same?
We don't know for certain. I mentioned Hur doesn't show up again after Moses heads up the mountain, but he's referenced his grandson is still around. As I said, there's a speculation. One Jewish tradition says that the people killed Hur when he wouldn't help build a golden calf. That's tradition and legend. It's not in the Bible, but it could be true. But if so, that didn't, you know, well, I'd say Hur was standing up for what's right. It could be that that's not true at all, and Hur is still around, and he's sitting there watching football on a Sunday afternoon while Aholiab's busy working. You know, we just don't know. But most people think it is the same her, okay. And I think probably so. So thanks for bringing that up. I thought to mention it, and then I didn't. Okay, so, we'll get through this, and then we have a break coming up in about 5 minutes. As I said, all these people, God's put the wisdom in their work. They're doing the skilled work. Chapter 36, verse 3, they received from Moses all the offering which the children of Israel had brought. So people are bringing stuff, and the skilled people are taking it, and they're working with it. Verse 4, the craftsmen who were doing all the work of the sanctuary came each from his work which he was doing. So the craftsmen have been getting this. Then they come to Moses. Verse 5 says, they spoke to Moses saying, the people bring much more than enough for the sacrifice or the service of the work they're doing. Look, they're doing great. They're bringing more than enough. And I got to pause here because let's give the people of ancient Israel credit when credit is due, because we point out a lot of bad mistakes they make. You know, they have their moral faults, but they tend to be generous. They were generous then. I think we could make the case that it is an Israelite trait that's passed through the ages. Even in modern times, you know, if we look at the English-speaking peoples, they tend to have their moral failings, but we tend to be a generous people. Well, I say we rather guardedly because I'm as tight as anything. You know, I'm not one that wants to give away money, but in general, our peoples are generous, and we see an example of it here. So I want to stop and give them credit. And I'll make note of something else. In verse 6, Moses gave a commandment, and they caused it to be proclaimed, let neither man or woman do any more work for the offering. So they didn't stop work on the tabernacle, but on the offering. We don't need more stuff. Because verse 7 says, the material they had was sufficient for the work to be done, indeed too much. Let's give the workmen credit. Because you know what they could have done? You know, they could have said, well, we got enough, but if people want to keep bringing in gold and silver, I'll just set it aside. And, you know, it's just extra here, so, you know, I'm working on cheap anyway, so I'll just put it in my bank account. They could have done that, but they didn't. You know, so they were, they were disinterested enough. I don't mean uninterested, but they didn't put any personal interest or enrichment ahead of serving the people. Look, we got enough to do the work. You guys keep your riches. We'll get this tabernacle built. You know, I'm not going to put in my pocket the extra. Stop bringing stuff. You know, they did the right thing, and I want to give them credit for it. And it's an example for us if we're ever in a situation like that. I love this page in my notes. It looks like this. Printer error. Luckily, I got the next one where I got the right stuff. I'm going to go on. Actually, the rest of chapter 36, verses 8 through 38, I'm going to cover in about a line or two because it recounts that they made the tabernacle following the instructions that God gave. And it, in some places, it's almost word for word with what was spoken when Moses was up on the mount. And I didn't read all of it then. I showed you pictures. Do I still have some pictures? Yeah, they made this. and what else? They made, I thought I had a picture of the priest. I think I put that away. I thought I saw a hand going up. And actually, I'm going to move ahead in chapter 37, verses 1 through 20. It continues. They did it. Meticulously describing chapter 37 and part of 38, it's very careful of describing the metalwork. Very artistic, elaborate, but Bezalel did just what God showed Moses. And again, you know, Moses apparently has the pattern. He's passing this on some way or another. Oh, I've got here, it's Exodus 25 has a lot of these instructions. So you can go back if you want to compare, which you probably only do that if you had a lot of extra time on your hands and you were bored. I think it's worth giving them credit. I'm giving Israel credit where I can for when they do something right, like giving much more than enough. They disobeyed God so many times. You know, I've wondered, why in the world does God repeat this stuff? He listed it before when he gave it to Moses. Why is he now later saying they did it and repeating it all again? Could have saved a lot of ink in our Bible. made it 4 or 5 pages shorter. Maybe God inspired Moses to put it in there to give him credit for some time when they did do right. You know, they sinned a lot of times, but here they did exactly what God said to do. With that, we're going to stop. Let's take a break. We'll pick up right here after about 10 minutes, and we're going to get, I plan to get to the end of Exodus today. We might even begin to introduce Leviticus. I'll keep, if you're wondering, my plan is to have a test on the latter part of Exodus and all of Leviticus. So we won't have a test in Pentateuch till we've started the next semester. So don't worry that I might be moving into Leviticus and that's an extra stress. I put those together because a lot of it is combined in how to worship God. So let's go ahead and take 10 and we'll start up again then.